Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 309. Thank you for tuning in, guys. I'm joined this week by Robert Eggers, who I was incredibly excited to sit down and have a conversation with. I spoke to a few of my close friends ahead of this one, and I was quite nervous about it because I'm a big fan of Robert's work. The Witch was an amazing debut, a mind-blowing debut. And then The Lighthouse had made it into my films of the year, and I'd not seen many interviews or conversations with Robert, and these films are like they're proper, you know. So I was quite nervous that I might, you know, I'm massively into film. I study it, I adore it, but you know, everyone has kind of imposter syndrome. Also in acting, I'm studying more and more, but everyone has kind of imposter syndrome, and I thought, what if I get there and I feel completely out of my depth? And I walked in and was instantly relaxed as soon as we started talking. Number one, we, you know, had similar beards and haircuts. We're both wearing all black, and it felt far more relaxed than I was expecting. And what unfolded was one of my favourite conversations. Far from feeling uncomfortable or out of my depth, I felt hugely excited to be discussing these things that excite me about film and about cinema and about the process and about the results. So yeah, it was a great conversation. I recorded it just before Christmas. Really pleased to have it out now. The reason it's out now is because The Lighthouse is in the cinemas this Friday, the 31st. Is the 31st the Friday? Let me have a look at my calendar. It's out this week anyway. Yeah, the 31st. And it's fantastic. As you know, it was in my Films of the Year podcast and list. The cinematography has got an Oscar nomination. And yeah, just generally praise all across the board. You'll hear from the conversation. I mean, there's not really any spoilers. We discussed the fact it's a bonkers film, like mad stuff happens. It's really, it's nuts. So we talk about some of that, but I don't really think there's spoilers. Obviously, I'd recommend just going and seeing the film. But yeah, thank you to everyone who tuned in last week for the Rob Alton episode. That got a lot of love. The Carl Pilkington episode is still getting a lot of love. I also had the Safdie brothers on earlier this year. Another pair of directors who had a film in my Films of the Year list. So go and check that out if you're checking out this one and you enjoy it. Other than that, I won't say too much. SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com is where you can buy my music, my merch, my DVDs, all the good shit. And Patreon.com/ScroobiousPip is there. It's kind of the whole idea of my Patreon is just the only thing you can pledge is $1 a month. You can't, there's not any tiers to get more. You pledge $1 a month if you feel that these free podcasts that I put out every week are worth $1, and you want to support and pay the people kind of behind the scenes and that kind of thing. So yeah, they are all the things. Not sure. In fact, let's just get into the podcast. I'll chat a little bit more about next week at the end. So yeah, this is episode 309 with Robert Eggers. Right, I'm joined today by Robert Eggers. How are you, sir?
Very well, thank you.
Good, good, good. I mean, we've just been having a catch-up off mic, so I feel insincere kind of in how are you finding the UK? I know you're here for a couple of days. We're here to talk about The Lighthouse, and it's a film that I've been waiting for a long time for kind of weird reasons. The original casting director, who was at least listed on IMDb, is one of the casting directors I hassle a lot for roles in stuff. And I always, I'm a nerd for this shit. So I'll spend my Sundays. I've told this on the podcast recently, going through IMDb for casting directors I want to work with, yeah, directors, all this kind of thing. And it was one that I kind of looked at. I was like, what the fuck is this film? Like, the description seemed quite odd and vague, and the cast seemed to have no one in it yet. It was like, it's in pre-production, it's good, yeah, to go. I was like, what's going on? So when I finally saw it in the cinema, it was already exciting, but then it was just, for something I'd been anticipating for so long, it still subverted every expectation I had, because it's just, there's so much in there. So how was it, I guess, to put together a project like this and get it over the line and get it made? Because it's unusual.
Yeah, I mean, look, I feel truly embarrassed, but people liked The Witch, which was a shock. Mm-hmm. I didn't think the movie was bad or anything like that. But I didn't think it would find as large of an audience as it did, and because it was a genre film, and because I'm American, sort of Hollywood saw that, like, I could potentially be used to make them money, yeah, doing bigger things. I've had kind of different opportunities because of that. But luckily, RT Features wanted to work with me again, A24 wanted to work with me again, and New Regency was willing to take the risk on something strange.
Yeah.
And so in this smaller setting, I had a good degree of control. And those financiers and distributor, like, gave me an incredible amount of freedom. Me and my other collaborators, I mean, we basically got to do what we wanted. There was wasn't a lot of compromise that didn't have to do with, like, physics, yeah, and Mother Nature and time.
Yeah.
And I understand that that's a very privileged place to be in, but I was for this, and I needed to seize the opportunity.
but it's a beautiful one, because it comes from how things played out naturally. As you said, you probably got a lot of freedom on The Witch, because it wasn't necessarily expected to be as big a film as it was. But therefore, if giving you that freedom gave them this huge instant cult classic kind of thing, it means that they're going to turn around and go, well, we'll just give you freedom again, I guess.
I guess.
Yeah. That's
lucky kind of me.
An ideal situation. Can we talk about the casting? Because it's mainly just Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. And
yeah,
their performances, like, what's asked of them is insane. Like, it's performances I've never seen from either of them. And, you know, they've both done some amazing performances over the years. Did you always have them in mind? Was there
I didn't have them in mind when I was writing, which was just sort of a superstition that I have, that don't imagine actors unless you absolutely know that they're going to say yes. Although, you know, Willem and I wanted to find something, and Rob and I wanted to find something. And when this became the thing on my slate that looked like it was going to go, there was absolutely no option.
Yeah,
you know? I mean,
yeah.
Who else could play these roles?
Yeah.
And who else would give themselves up to these roles and the demands of the story, you know, and with the weather and the hardships that they had to endure, not a lot of people would. You know, both this and The Witch and the thing I'm working on now, I kind of have to say, you know, it's going to be cold, it's going to be miserable, and we're going to be out there in you know, on the top of a mountain, or in the middle of the ocean, or in the middle of the woods, and that's just what it's going to be. So I hope you're ready to strap in.
Or that's what I loved about it. We're recording this a little bit before New Year's Eve, and I have a New Year's Eve tradition of, I stay in normally on my own. I select the film in advance and I eat some really nice food. And one of my favourite ones of that was Aguirre, Wrath of God.
Oh,
and
yeah,
that came to mind when I was watching The Lighthouse and Mono's earlier this year as well, as films that I'm appreciating on an artistic level, but I'm also afterwards going, man, that must have been physically and mentally taxing on everyone involved to make it. It must have been, as you say, a huge undertaking to warn them in advance and say, look, this isn't going to be fun.
Yeah, but and there is fun in that. You know, there's completely fun in conquering it. But, you know, when it's 0 degrees with gale force winds and freezing rain, you can't – on a rock in the middle of the North Atlantic, like, you can't move quickly. You know, camera equipment's going to break down. Like, and every day was – so if it was bad weather, we were excited because we were shooting our exteriors, but we were getting behind schedule because we're moving slowly. Yeah. And then if it's nice weather, we're getting behind schedule because there's not very much that we can shoot with nice weather. So we're, like, you know, inside trying to do that. So it was always tricky. And the scene work was demanding. I mean, there was not a lot of joking around on set. People needed to be very focused. I was approving the DVD or Blu-ray extras, and there's lots of like me and Rob and Willem like laughing and patting shoulders. And I was like, wow, they must have found every, like all 15 times we ever did that, you know?
I love that.
But yeah, I mean, there was much more like focus and endurance, and then going to your hotel room to get dry, get warm, cry and drink to get ready for the next day.
Yeah. Like, how was it to direct them in these situations? I mean, it strikes me that from what you've said there, I would assume there was a lot of rehearsal so that you're good to go when the weather allows you. Because if you're so dependent on the weather, you can't have that, oh, we'll do this 20 times, 30 times. It's like we need to be prepared, as you said, to go when we go.
Yeah, there was a week of rehearsal, which felt like 3 weeks to Robert Pattinson, and that was very important to learn the blocking beforehand. I mean, Willem comes from theater. He doesn't necessarily need rehearsal. He's done films where he's improvised, you know, in Italian and, you know, off the cuff, right?
Yeah.
But he comes from theater and understands that discipline and found it to be very enjoyable. But Rob really didn't enjoy the rehearsal process and found it like stifling. But that was kind of a great tension in their characters.
Yeah.
You know? And I wasn't like, I'm not some Kubrickian sadistic manipulator that's trying to like create uncomfortable and negative tensions on set, but the camera sees what the camera sees.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And again, someone like Robert, who's a great actor, will know that that can be put into the character. Again, the character is,
of course,
the whole point of the character is he's uncomfortable. He's not happy to be there, essentially.
Exactly.
He's there out of necessity. So the more he's feeling that, the more layers there's going to be, you know?
And how much is that like just them? How much is that them unconsciously becoming the character or relating to the character or consciously doing that? Hopefully it works.
Yeah. I love it. It works amazingly. But so did you have to direct them differently? Because again, you've said that Willem has so much experience in that area and Robert found the approach stifling. Did that mean you had to adjust your approach as the director and have these intense, because they will have had to have an intense, a one-on-one relationship with each other in filming. And it feels like you would have had to have quite one-on-one relationships with either of them as well.
Yeah. And I think part of it is this movie. Mm. I think part of it is these characters. And I think part of it is how these actors are working in these settings. And then with me, I think that if I worked with Defoe or Rob in another movie, it might be very different. But on this movie, like with Willem, it was nearly all like technical, and certainly I gave Rob technical directions, usually just like faster, but Rob had a lot more questions about his backstory and his past and so on and so forth. And he needed answers to these questions to like perform the scene. Whereas, you know, Willem didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. But again,
there's a poetic beauty.
I was going to say there's a poetic beauty in that. Cause we get this backstory unraveling and we get kind of no backstory on Willem. It's kind of like, he is this mysterious, and Robert's character in the movie has no backstory on Willem.
Right.
And it's kind of, it all plays in beautifully there. So, I mean, I've talked about those one-on-one relationships and the approach that you've had to take, but it feels like the kind of the fourth piece of the puzzle is it Jaren?
I went before I met him like 15 years ago, or probably just 10, but I don't know. Feels like longer, Jaren.
Yeah.
I thought it was Jaren Blaschke, but it's Jaren Blaschke.
It's confusing because you try and be educated on languages, and in Portuguese the R becomes a H, but in Spanish, in Mexican, it doesn't. It remains, the J remains a J, or no, the J becomes an H. It's so confusing. But anyway, names aside, Jaren, the cinematographer who you worked with on The Witch as well.
Mm-hmm. He also did my short films that aren't rubbish, as you'd say over here. and we worked together a lot when I was in the art department, like on other directors' films.
So how key a part is that relationship? Because it feels like, again, we're seeing the actors have to go through this experience. We're knowing the director has to go through this experience. It's easy to forget that there's a cinematographer there who's having to go through it and having to pick out the beauty in it all.
Yeah, I mean, Jaron said that he'd never worked on a film where the shooting of the film so closely mirrored the story.
Yeah.
So he was part of that too. If anyone has anything nice or not nice to say about the cinematic language of my movies, I mean, it's very much a collaboration between me and Jaron. If it wasn't for Jaron, my films would be way less visually compelling. Certainly the production design and the costumes would be as specific, but I think it would be a little bit more expected otherwise. We plan the shots together. This is an oversimplification, but I would say that generally Jaron elevates my ideas and I simplify his.
Right.
But we're trying to find something that's very essential and spare, something that every cut it matters. Every cut is there for a reason. Obviously, like when you're doing something that's shot for shot, like that, those cuts all are about me and Louise Ford, the editor's work, but so much of the film is very much designed and knowing that, you know, if the last image is a close up of a pillow, that a wide shot of a rock might be a nice thing to cut to as a visual juxtaposition if that so serves the story and so on.
Yeah.
You know.
How is that as a director, kind of particularly as a young and new director who's instantly kind of getting a lot of respect and attention and praise early on? How is it being, because you seem very aware very early that it's such a collaboration, and you know it might be thought of as a Robert Eggers film, but it's such a collaborative process, and the editing, again, I think in The Lighthouse in particular, it's such a key part because there's so many bits that do just juxtapose perfectly and lead you on, or just a jarring, like out of nowhere, make you jump. And it's everyone are working on that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, some European and South American posters write a film by Robert Eggers by mistake, but I don't take that credit because it is a collaboration between everyone. And Jaron and Louise, I've been working with for over 10 years, but Craig and Linda, the costume designer and production designer, were from The Witch and on The Lighthouse, and we're all working together on the next film. And as we work together with each other more and more often, like the shorthand becomes more clear and precise, and everyone can expect and know what people need. And we also know even better how to push each other.
Yeah.
You know, because we also know what we were and weren't satisfied with in the last film so that we can, you know, hopefully grow and develop together.
I love that. And it feels like a film like The Lighthouse would fast track that shorthand intensely, particularly with Jaron, like with anyone on location, essentially, that shorthand had to become instant because, and I mean, I'd like to talk more about the location, and I've just realized we've not really said anything about the film. Essentially, it's set in a lighthouse, and it's
takes place at the turn of the century, far off the coast of Maine, though it could be, you know, once upon a time.
Yeah.
And it's a mysterious island, and a storm comes and they get marooned on the island, and things, you know, go from bad to worse. And the shorter version is nothing good happens to two men trapped in a giant phallus.
So at what point on finding the location, or was there a point that the excitement of finding this perfect, amazing location wore off enough for you to go, oh, fuck, we're going to have to be on this seemingly secluded, quite out of anywhere, you know, hard to shoot type
Yeah, we were there on a scout on a recce after, like, we'd already chosen the location they had started building, and we were there just trying to plan some shots. And it was the day after a nor'easter, and it was, and the wind was so loud that we couldn't hear each other. Yeah. We were like less than a meter apart, and we couldn't hear each other. And it was just relentless. And our faces were like, felt like they were gonna like fall off of our heads. And we thought, oh my goodness, like we are here for so long.
Yeah.
Like, and we're just gonna have to deal with it. But you know, it's, again, as I said, it is fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, like, did we complain when we were doing it? Like, of course, you know, when we got home to the hotel or the whatever. But, or, you know, Defoe had a little fisherman's cottage that he would live by himself.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway.
But those things can often feel all the more rewarding. I always remember my favorite ever day on set was one that overran hugely, and I was on set for over 12 hours, not always in use, but, you know, over 12 hours, and I got home. And I still did my day's workout, and I felt like a fucking superhero because I was like, I've done this and I've done my fucking, I've not missed my workout. Yeah. I'm still, and that's, it said, it seems stupid, but it's those things that do, it's those hardships that make you go, how fucking amazing are we for making this happen, for survivors, and how many other people would have gone, oh, we need to stop shooting, or we can't make this happen today, or we need to change the location. There's that sense of achievement is built into that hardship.
Yeah, I think so. And again, these challenges, they make the work better. Like if it were easy, like it wouldn't be as good.
Yeah.
If we faked all of that, like it wouldn't have been, you wouldn't have felt it as an audience member.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. And again, you do, it's, I mean, that's something that's interesting to talk about as well. How do you feel about the kind of change that we're seeing in how people watch films? Because as an audience member in the cinema, you feel every moment of this, because it's, I always remember going to see Irreversible and feeling like I was going to have a heart attack at the end, because the strobing kind of thing, and there's some similar moments in this that it felt like the room was shaking, and it's overwhelming in a beautiful way. It might not translate completely the same way on TV, but you, I mean, you shot it in
119 to 1 aspect ratio.
I was going
to
sound, I was going to try and quote something. I was like, just, no. I'll let you tell me what ratio. But so that, again, that is not traditionally the cinematic ratio. So what are your kind of feelings on all of that world of cinema and non-cinema and the changes?
I mean, obviously, like, I'd prefer to have both of my films watched in a movie theater with an audience. Yeah. That would be my preference. It ain't going to be that way all the time.
Yeah.
And this, I think both of my feature films are tricky things to kind of watch at home. You know, Bergman works better at home than Tarkovsky because Bergman's so fond of close-ups.
Yeah.
Like, you know, is it better to see Persona like in a movie theater if you get the opportunity? Oh yeah.
But because
of his like love of the close up and the fact that so much of his films are dialogue driven, like you can feel a whole lot when you're watching it like on your iPhone. I've never done that, but you know, whatever. that's not true. I watched a Kurosawa movie like on my phone, like stuck in traffic from like Heathrow to London, but who can blame me,
film. You know?
Yeah. So anyway, but then like Tarkovsky, when it's not about story in the same narrative way, and there's so much more atmosphere and all this stuff. Like, certainly, you know, I watched all of his films on a television before I ever saw any of them in a cinema, but it was an entirely different thing to see his films on cinema in a cinema.
Yeah, you know? I completely agree, and it's tough on the streaming thing, because you're right there, and something that has jumped out to me in your work that feels very European is your comfort with time, with allowing things to play out, with allowing space.
And that's
a dangerous thing at home.
It is because
of phones
you're like, oh, like nothing's happening and like get on with it. And also, you know, another issue is The Witch is quite dark. And so if depending on your television and your streaming speed, if you're watching The Witch on Netflix, it just becomes like a whole bunch of blocks of compressed garbage and you can't like even see it. So yeah, but on the other hand, streaming services give a platform to a lot of people to like have their film seen, and and having Netflix made it so that The Witch found a whole new audience like after the theatrical release, and that like because it was, you know, The Witch was its thing, great, made some money, whatever. Then, you know, Anya was in that M. Night Shyamalan movie, the first one that was quite successful, and she had a lot of people who were aware of her from that, and then that, you know, seeing her on Netflix, they watched The Witch, and you know, and that's cool, because I think when The Witch first came out, also there was, for a lot of audiences, like the slowness and the sort of. I think the narrative's quite clear, but compared to a lot of traditional Hollywood dramaturgy, like it's got more space and mystery and things aren't spelled out, even if they're implied. And I think that didn't work well for a lot of audiences. But I think since then, there's been more and more and more films like that. Yeah. So having The Witch on Netflix makes it so that like some people now are like open to watching The Witch that maybe wouldn't have been open to watching The Witch when it originally came out. So that's cool. But I think that all these streaming services are great and should continue to grow and do their thing, but people should still keep going to the movies.
Yeah, it's exactly the thing. It's something I rant about every now and then online, and I shouldn't be on social media. It's the death of society. But every now and then I'll rant about it because I've come to that conclusion that it is on us as the viewing public. And that's a horrible thing to let people know, that it's our responsibility, because I do agree. I think streaming services are amazing. I think they've brought access to so many different films and so much different TV, yet the cinema is dying because we're not respecting the difference between watching at home and watching in the cinema. And I go and see at least 100 films a year in the cinema, and I adore it. And again, it's a bittersweet thing, because I quite enjoy when the cinema's empty and I'm watching it on my own. But it's also sad, because it's like, this shouldn't be empty. This is an amazing an amazing film. Well, I mean, time's an interesting one here, because when I was doing my prep, I was going off, I was looking on IMDb and I was like, man, there's a fair old gap between The Witch and The Lighthouse. Okay. But there kind of isn't as well, because The Witch, it's not as simple as you've stated, as the release date, because The Witch did have its release and then it had its streaming service kind of boom and grow. So it felt like it wasn't that it wasn't a film that was all about that first weekend.
Yeah,
it was a film that was about growing and growing and becoming more known and renowned.
And I mean, and starting with the premiere at Sundance in January of 2015, and our release was in like February or March of 2016.
Yeah.
In the US.
Yeah.
It had been around for a while, but no, there was a gap. I mean, but it was, I was working diligently all 4 years, but only one of the four things that I wrote and developed got greenlit.
Yeah, yeah. So, what's your writing process? Because you wrote The Lighthouse with your brother, right?
Yeah.
So what's the process on that? And how do you decide the project that you want to work on and jump into?
Well, if I like an idea, I just kind of explore it until it doesn't work anymore. And then when it doesn't work, I move on. But if it's working, then I keep going and then try to get it made, and then that may or may not happen.
Yes.
I mean, I have to have more than one thing going at once, because stuff falls through.
Yeah.
And I think like in knowing that I need to have more than one thing going, I have found it better to have writing collaborators, because it's easier to kind of divide and conquer that way.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense.
I know that other filmmakers who are writer directors like don't necessarily need that. I think that, but I'm also really just enjoying working with another writer because the collaboration is fun. You know, working with my brother was incredibly fun. And on my next film, or hopefully my next film, I wrote that with this Icelandic novelist and poet Sjón. And it's also been just like a joy when you pass these scenes back and forth and the next person keeps like sprucing it up and sprucing it. And, you know, and it's fun.
Yeah. And again, I'd imagine the excitement, particularly as you've worked on period pieces each time, so the excitement if the collaborator brings in some new information, something you didn't know about it. It's like, oh shit, this is amazing! Like even just from a personal point of view, to go, I didn't know that. I didn't know that it was like that. And it must be a buzz, right?
That's great. Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah,
it's from my trips around America over the years. Like one of the things that struck me early on was America feels like it's not got much history in comparison to England and the UK. But then when we got to go and tour and gig in New England, that was the kind of bit that seemed to have a bit more variation and history. Do you think your kind of upbringing there and growing up there is what's made you kind of interested in these period type pieces?
Yeah, for sure. My earliest years were actually, my very, very earliest years were actually in Wyoming.
Right.
But I think in there, that also has a kind of, like Wyoming's different from Colorado, and Wyoming, you definitely feel like it's cowboy country. So thing. And then in New England, when you're surrounded with like clabbered farmhouses and old field boundaries and graveyards in the middle of the woods from the 18th century, like how are you not going to think about it? I mean, look, many people do. Many New Englanders like their Red Sox and their Bruins and their lobster rolls and don't care. But, you know, I was a weird, arty, gothy kid. So what can you say?
It feels like a part of America where they didn't have the thought process of that's old, let's knock it down and build something new. It feels like they've kept a lot of the old and not kind of just gone, we need to be the most modern, because it's a modern country. That's been the drive of the country for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, when we were shooting The Witch in Ontario, I was very struck by the fact that like there was like no vernacular architectural traditions in Ontario, and that like everyone just kind of has like vinyl siding or like concrete block houses in the country.
Yeah.
It's all very practical. So I understand it, but like in New England, you know, like obviously there's vinyl siding and trailer parks and everything, but there are a lot of people, even people who like are experiencing rural poverty, that like are proud of their like New England clabbered house and they're not gonna like replace their rotten clabbards with pine. They're gonna wait until they have the money to like put in some new cedar clabbards. That does exist and it is, you know, it is hard to find the kind of folkloric New England, like it exists, but you have to kind of look for it in a way that it seems to me in the greater British Isles, including Ireland, that it is just kind of is still here.
Yeah.
You don't have to look for it. It's not hard to like find someone who can talk about fairy trees and fairy rings.
Yeah.
But it is, trickier in New England.
It's exactly the same though. Of here, it's as easy to ignore it, and all of the history in particular, just whether it be folklore or just literally architecture, just walking around London, it's easy to ignore the hundreds of years of stuff. But yeah,
I guess I'm coming over here like tuned into a different thing. Plus, I have my interests. So, and also the many of the Brits that I've become friends with like share the same interests as me. So then there you go.
Exactly the same. The reason I noticed it in New England was Sage Francis and B. Dolan are two rappers from Providence. I wrote, and when I went over there for their like a wedding or whatever, it's like, look, here's some cool shit.
Here's the good stuff
around here, rather than just I might see it, I might not. So it's finding the right people to open that up to you, I guess. Have you spent much time in the UK over the years? I know you're here now and you're around a bit, but is it somewhere you've visited a lot or had a connection with?
Yeah, I've been to London a lot, and we did some casting in Yorkshire for The Witch, mm-hmm. but I've been to London a lot, and I like it, and I am I'm a bit of an Anglophile, like, so I do feel a sense of belonging when I'm here. Yeah. I definitely, like, my wife and I fantasize about living here.
It's funny because it's the same with all my New England, like all my guys who are from that kind of era. All they come to you can go, oh, this is where we're meant to be. Like we've been touring LA and so I'm feeling like outcasts, and they come here and go, all right, you get us. Yeah. You get our outlook and our approach.
Absolutely. it's warmer than New England. When I go to Catholic countries, I really realize how Protestant the sort of patriarchal culture of the United States is.
Yeah.
Like, so Protestant. And then, but New England is just its own thing. New Englanders are cold. Yeah. I mean, when you go to the local diner, the waitress just gives you like nothing. Yeah. Like, maybe by the end of the meal, like, if you've behaved yourself, like, she might say like one nice kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's, when I because I'm in Belfast right now, everyone's so friendly. Like, I have to remind myself that, like, this is like a genuine behavior of human beings, and they're not like mentally ill, because they're just so nice and they mean it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Again, but it's fascinating to see those characteristic traits in different places and different areas, and to be able to appreciate both.
Yeah.
You know, I love going in them diners and feeling like, this isn't the woman who works in the diner. This is the matriarch of the town.
Yeah.
Like, she's everyone's mum, and she's making sure that no trouble's coming in or out. And it's like, I just wanted a sandwich with loads of meat in it in this scenario.
I will share this anecdote. In the diner in Epping, where my family lived for a long time, in southern New Hampshire, it was called Pam and Cheryl's Family Restaurant.
Yeah.
And Pam and Cheryl had like a big falling out, and it was like the talk of the small town. And Cheryl, they had a green awning that said Pam and Cheryl's, and she just took white paint and she painted out Pam, and it just said like Cheryl's with all this white dripping paint, you know.
I adore small town drama. Yeah. I love that kind of thing. It's the only reason I ever look through. I live in a small town in Essex outside of London, and it's the only reason I look through the local paper, like the local newspaper. There's nothing I want in there other than like the letters page where people are just being bitches clearly about someone and passive aggressive.
Yeah.
Wow. If someone, it's like, I love that shit.
Yeah.
We've talked about kind of the use of time and pacing. I think another thing that really strikes me is your comfort with silence or not necessarily silence, but a lack of dialogue. And it's easy to look at films like Odette and things like that, that are the kind of classics of slow pacing and silence. But it really means that when you get the audience into a real comfort and you've got the control to shake them out of it at any point, there's points where the two characters are barely communicating. And it means that when they're really actively communicating, because again, I was going to say furiously, but there's points where they're really friendly actively. Yeah. Communicating, it has that impact. So is that something that is important to you, to not be pulled into the kind of, as you said, the need to be quick dialogue constantly back and forth?
Well, I think it depends on the story that you're telling. I like a movie about a nun praying silently for one shot, like, could be something that I could be really into. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If it was done well. So that there is like a bit of just, that's kind of like my taste. But I think that also this is a story about isolation, among other things. So there is going to be silence, like, in in the storytelling.
Yeah.
And you're also thinking, when you have two actors only, more or less, like, what are my tools like to use to tell this story? And it can't all be dialogue scenes, or it really should be a play. You know, there are things about this that are drawn and inspired by theatrical traditions, and there are things that feel somewhat like a play. But there are other things that, you know, wouldn't work on stage. But also, I mean, I am fond of silent cinema, and I did a was working on a remake of Nosferatu, for better or for worse. And I you know, asked the studio executives to watch the original film. And, you know, I don't think many of them had seen a silent movie maybe since film school, if they went to film school, and were all kind of amazed that you could tell a story without dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, and you can. And I think The Lighthouse doesn't entirely hold this true, but mostly. But I think The Witch does, which is that I try to make it so that even if you didn't have dialogue, that the visual storytelling is clear enough to tell the story.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the great teachers, Hitchcock, would always watch his movies in post without sound, like, many times, to make sure that, like, the visual storytelling was clear without the dialogue.
I love that, like, Malgram, kind of the guy who's my acting teacher, was taught by Malgram, and one of the things he said in class was, like, when you want to learn from good actors, put a good film on and turn the sound off and see how much you get from it. And even if it's your favorite film that you know really well, you'll notice different things and you'll get that. And I think that's amazing. It's really interesting what you said there about it not being theatre, because you have a background in theatre, right? And Bresson would speak, you know, kind of furiously about the fact that if you're making film, make film.
Yeah.
Don't just film a play.
Yeah.
And again, I think that's something you've nailed here as well. It's finding those things that go, right, this is its own medium. It's not a way of getting plays out into the world.
Yeah,
it's its own medium. So how important is that? And I'd imagine that's a lot of conversation between you and Jaron as well, of going, what can we do that we couldn't do in any other way? Why is this a film rather than a novel or a play?
Right.
Why is it a cinematic piece?
And I think that, like, you know, there are some things that I think maybe Bresson would not like about this movie, which is fine.
I mean, he's too harsh sometimes. He's
but I mean, you know, his guidelines are his notes on cinematography, like, are they're a nice set of rules to consider when you're writing. And when
I've got a folder in my photos of here of just my favorite bits from that book, just from where I've been reading. Like, I need to have that on me at all times.
No, it's important. Reference. It's important. I think it's also important. Like, I think that his, you know, mannequin acting, like, while there's certain kinds of stories and films that just wouldn't serve.
Yeah.
But I think it's good for actors, though, to kind of consider what just stillness and being and how powerful that can be.
Yeah.
I'm, like, super digressing. I don't remember the question anymore, but, you know, but, like, Peter Brook talks about, like, how, you know, the non-actor performance, like, is, you know, very often better than the actor performance because they can just, like, be. And it takes a lot more craft and rigor to as an actor to seem that effortless.
I think it comes back to what you revealed earlier about a Robert, is the fact that he was genuinely feeling anxious and frustrated means that's one less thing for him to play.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? It generally, it takes that. And I think that's a really important thing in acting at times. It's finding the things that are there anyway and going, right, that's dealt with. That's already given.
And that's what Defoe says all the time. It's like, you know, like, when, this is a spoiler, sort of, when I was being interviewed about, like for the DGA and Ryan Johnson asked me, like, did you film Defoe being buried, the overhead shot, like, on stage? And I thought, oh, that would have been a nice thing to do. Like, I probably should have done that for Willem. And I mentioned that to Willem, like, later that day, because we were doing press in LA.
Yeah.
And he was like, are you kidding me? He was like, obviously, like, I wanted to fucking murder you when you were burying me alive, but, like, I didn't have to act.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you were burying me alive, and you were throwing dirt in my face, and it was freezing. Like, thank God you didn't shoot that on stage.
Yeah, and it comes across. It comes across exactly like that, because you are sitting there going, is this going to cut in a minute? Are we going to can we leave this, please, now? And yeah. it continues there, and that puts the viewer in that discomfort as well in many ways.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating one. Well, I mean, we're getting closer and closer to our time limit, but can we talk a little bit about score? Because, again, it's such a powerful and moving part in The Witch and in The Lighthouse. But The Lighthouse, again, The Witch is one that I did see at home, and The Lighthouse is one that I saw in the cinema, so it hit me that much more.
Yeah.
How key is that to the storytelling for you?
I mean, it's huge. I think both movies, like, when I sat down to write them, I was like, there will be no score in either of these movies. They're going to be very austere and, like, whatever. I think with The Witch, it was clear that there, when the supernatural stuff was going down, that, like, we needed score to articulate a kind of emotional reality or unreality that you can't be articulated without music, or yeah. or you know, maybe a better filmmaker could. I couldn't. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those like, while in general the score is very minimalist in the film and sort of supportive, when The Witch is around, it takes over all the diegetic sound, and yeah. it just becomes like a wall of music. Yeah. So, I mean, that was something that, like, developed, but it was clear that that's what it needed to be. The Lighthouse also sort of developed, like, contrary to my preconceived notions, because The Witch was so string heavy. I said to Mark Corvin, the composer, like, I don't want to have any strings
yeah.
at all, because we, like, The Witch is so string heavy. And I feel like in a post Johnny Greenwood world, like, it's been done to death.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great thing. I love it. I still listen to stuff like that sometimes. I listened to it this morning. Some Hildur Guðnadóttir, any of her movie scores, but her, like, solo work, but one thing different. So it's all going to be like brass, horns, pipes, like things that are like the sea, so things that are like yeah. the foghorn, things that are like Willem Dafoe's flatulence.
Yeah.
and Mark was like, I think you're still going to want to have some string textures. And in fact, he was right, you know, but it was an evolution to get there. It was fun.
I love it. Willem Dafoe's flatulence is a key part in this, and it cracked me up because of different podcasts I'd go, and I had to do a double bill of the first film I saw was Jay and Silent Bob reboot,
uh-huh.
and then the next one was The Lighthouse, which are two very different films, but I didn't expect The Lighthouse to have more fart jokes than Jay and Silent Bob the reboot. But so, like, how important is that to have those kind of things? Because I, in my music career, a lot of my stuff lyrically was about, there was stuff about suicide, there was domestic violence. It was quite dark stories, and it was important to me in between to have some lightheartedness. Number one, to give people a break, but number two, to make the impact of the heaviness all the more. Was that kind of something here? Because there was humour throughout this, which I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, I think that The Witch takes itself so fucking seriously, which I think, unfortunately, it sort of needs to work, because yeah. it is a film about despair and about Puritans in despair, and yeah. they don't have a sense of humor, so I guess yeah. the film can't really either. But I felt like if I was going to explore misery again, I needed to be able to laugh at it,
yeah.
And like to sound like a what I you know whatever. Like I was, it was like what really clarified this to me was like reading Dostoevsky and like and really like laughing my ass off and yeah. thinking, you know, if he can have a sense of humor, like yeah. why am I trying to be so serious?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, completely. I love that. Well, I mean, to wrap things up, I guess I'll ask what's ahead. It's always a tough question, 'cause it's normally stuff that you can't talk about, but what is the plan? You've got a project that you're trying to get going at the moment, I believe. And then what's the goal?
Yeah. I mean, it was leaked that I'm doing a Viking revenge
yes.
saga. So, And you know, and we're moving along, but until I'm on an set saying action, I don't really believe it. So I've said this to end a lot of interviews lately. So apologies for being repetitive.
It's fine. For me, like I had a costume fitting last week for a TV show I'm doing next week, and a costume's fitting next week for a film I'm doing at the start of next year. And both of them, it's like until the costume's actually been done, I won't even entertain the idea that I'm working at all. There's no work to come until I'm literally, right, we've got the costume now. Come on, this is...
Yeah, you'd think so.
It's probably...
No, but I mean, but you know, you hear stories and you're like, oh man, like Aronofsky had to pack up all the sets that he built for The Fountain in Australia to then like make it 2 years later in Montreal. So you never know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's the plan and the hope.
That's the plan and the hope.
Well, perfect. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure. Cheers.
Yeah, thanks.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There you go. How good was that? As said, I really, really enjoyed that conversation. You might have heard that maybe I started off a bit nervous, and then every time we clicked onto something that I was like, oh, I know about that. I love that too. I got more and more excited because it was, you know, one of my problems as an interviewer, again, I always say that these podcasts are conversations rather than interviews, because one of my problems as an interviewer is I get really fucking excited when I'm talking to people that I admire and talking about stuff that I adore, that I'm obsessed with. And I think that came out a fair few times. It's like, oh shit, yeah, I know about that. I read this book that said this. And then, yeah. There's a lot of back and forth on that. So that was super, super cool. So, I hope you enjoyed this episode. I'm not sure who next week's guest is going to be. I've got a few recorded. As some of you will know, last week's was meant to be Rosie Marcel. And that got pushed because of some issues with some spoilers that we put in there. So I might do a Q&A for next week. I've got more recorded. I've got others recorded, but I want to release them at the most prevalent times. I had an amazing chat with Graham Fellows, a.k.a. John Shuttleworth, and his tour's just starting, so maybe I'll move that forward, but I wanted to put it out around the time of his book. Anyway, this is all really boring and non-important information for you guys, but that's where we are. I also want to record an episode with Buddy Peace and 76, the kind of the behind the scenes of the Distraction Pieces network. Maybe John Harris in there as well, do a bit of a round table. But yeah, anyway, we'll have a think on all that and I'll figure it out. But I'll see you all next week. Thank you for tuning in. As ever, this has been the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 309 with Robert motherfucking Eggers. Ta-ta.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.